Welcome to the Masculinist Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Wren. To keep up with all the content and subscribe to my flagship newsletter, please visit themasculinist.com. And now for today's episode. Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome back to the podcast. I usually record these on Tuesday and post them on Wednesdays, but what I'm going to go ahead and do is, as soon as I finish recording this and uploading it, I'll probably go ahead and just officially post it, because tomorrow I'm planning to put out the next Masculinist newsletter, and then there will be another podcast shortly with that, so I'll try to get this out to you slightly early. Now, last week I said I was going to talk about a reader question I got that was basically, should Christians cheer for the United States to collapse? Now, he didn't put it exactly like that, and we'll go into that more in detail when we cover it. But I'm actually not going to talk about that today on the belief that the United States will not be collapsing in the next few days, and we'll have plenty of time to get to that one. And instead, I want to talk about a news article that caught my attention and ties back to something that I had done a podcast on a few months ago, or maybe almost a year ago now. The second big series that I did on the podcast when I started it was a series about political conservatism, kind of its history, its origins, and many aspects of it that people might not know. Because a lot of my listeners are political conservatives, and, you know, that's what I was. You know, I grew up in the 80s in rural southern Indiana, you know, child of the Reagan era. And, you know, I just kind of grew up as a conservative and took all these ideas for granted. And then I found myself, you know, working at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank in New York City, and realizing, you know what? I don't even know where these ideas came from. You know, I don't really know anything about this movement and where it came from. So I started studying the history of conservatism. And so I wanted to do a podcast series about that, to kind of give people something of a history of the origins of conservatives and many aspects of that that you may never have thought about before, or certainly things that, you know, the conservatives themselves are never going to tell you, because they've essentially rewritten kind of the official story on their history a few times. And so one of the episodes that I did was called something like Once More Into the Breach. And I was reading a book, I think it's called The Conservative Intellectual Movement in America, by a historian named George Nash. This is the canonical history of the early days of the conservative movement. It was written originally in the 70s, and it sort of talks about how conservatism gets going in the post-war era, you know, drawing on some pre-war threads, and then how it essentially developed into this force that had become a real political movement in the United States. And again, the focus was on the intellectual side of it, more so than the electoral politics side. But one thing that really struck me from that book was, in the 60s, when the sort of campus unrest started, the conservative movement was alarmed, because you had all these student radicals who were doing these sit-ins, occupying administration buildings, essentially trying to overturn the authority structure of the university, and conservatives were horrified. They're like, civilization is about to fall. This is a threat to American civilization, and we have to oppose it. And it really struck me that, wait a minute, the administrators of those universities were all liberals, liberals who held conservatism and its values in total contempt. You may recall back in the 50s, when William F. Buckley wrote his book, God and Man at Yale, about his experiences at Yale and what he saw at Yale, you know, the establishment of Yale and this WASP elite of all these, you know, Ivy League schools, that they trashed him, man. I mean, he got trashed for that. And yet, you know, a decade later, those same people are all under siege by these student radicals. And like, here's the Buckleyites running to defend them. And I'm like, that's curious, right? If these student radicals are threatening the university administration, well, that's their problem. That's the administration's problem. That's not the conservatives' problem, particularly since at the time, conservatism was still a small movement. In fact, one that had not long before suffered a crushing defeat in the 64 election with Goldwater, which in a sense, you know, it was their triumph in being able to nominate him, but he was just wrecked. And so conservatism was still kind of a dissident outsider movement at that point. And yet here they come to the defense of the citadels of their enemies, the very people who were totally opposed to them. And so this is something that you've seen and I've noticed, this idea of conservatives trying to jump into the breach when essentially leftist authorities, you know, center-left authorities are under siege from the far left. In other words, when they're in danger from essentially their own ideologies, then, you know, the conservatives jump in to try to, you know, save these, you know, leftist institutions. I don't get it. And so we see this again this week. There was an article, you may have seen it, that New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has announced that the city is going to be eliminating its gifted and talented programs in its public school systems. Now, they're not going to shut down the program for the existing people who are already in it, but there will be no new cohorts of gifted and talented students in the New York City school system. Now, this may or may not happen. New York is about to elect a new mayor, so the new mayor may decide not to do that. It's a good chance this is sort of grandstanding by de Blasio on the way out the door. So don't read too much even into whether that'll happen. But this just, you know, created conservative outrage. Right? It was just, I saw these conservatives going crazy on Twitter, like, what's going on about this? Now, the reason he's shutting it down is because, you know, de Blasio says that it's not diverse enough. So the gifted and talented programs in New York City public schools are 43% Asian and 36% white. So they're like, we can't let that, so let's just kill them, let's just eliminate them. Now, again, I get it. If you're from New York City, you know, it's like, you know, my former Manhattan Institute colleagues, right? They're based in New York, right? That's their city. I understand why they care about it. You know, I can understand if you're just a conservative person who talks about ed policy in general, right? But why so many people concerned about what crazy Bill de Blasio is doing in New York? I mean, there are hardly any conservatives in New York City. And, you know, I went looking for, you know, some of the voting demographics in New York, and I was not able to get city election results in the city of New York by race, but nationally, 63% of Asians voted for Joe Biden. So Asians in America overwhelmingly vote Democrat. Whites in New York City are famously liberal. I mean, they're far, probably way more than 63% of them are to the left, right? And in essence, right, this is kind of what they voted for. Most likely, the parents of the kids who were in the gifted and talented programs in New York and the parents of the kids who would be in it next year, you know, if it happened, voted for de Blasio, right? That's their problem. Maybe they should think about that. Why is that the conservatives' problem when you think about all the things that are going on in the world and all the things that pose a direct threat to conservative voters, especially in conservative states? I mean, they got a lot of business to take care of, you know, close to home. It's like attacking stuff that's happening in California, in San Francisco, in New York. It just seems to be their favorite thing to do. And I think some of it's a distraction. Maybe we'll come back to that in a minute. But then when you look at like how they argue about it and all this stuff, it's actually not even particularly effective. So, you know, one of the things you see is that they tend to argue that, well, this would be wrong. Don't you know that these gifted and talented programs are mostly Asian? If you cared about minorities and diversity, wouldn't you care about these programs? So, in other words, although all these conservative voters and tweeters are white, they can't actually defend white kids. They just are physically incapable of standing up and saying, this is unfair to white kids. So they have to sort of hide behind a minority. They have to have an Asian or a minority to hide behind. So they're not even actually that especially, willing to, you know, full-throatedly repudiate it. And then, you know, I think they've got this idea, they got this sort of like glittering trinket that they think that says, oh, you know, we can defend merit-based admissions in colleges and, you know, gifted and talented programs and the selective high schools in New York. And that will help us to attract the Asian voters because Asians are being discriminated against, which is true. Well, not the selective high schools in New York, because those are all by exam, but like you look at the Ivy League, it's very well established that, you know, Asians are being discriminated against today. There's essentially a quota, just like there used to be Jewish quotas, and there's essentially de facto Asian quotas. And there's no doubt that those selective high schools in New York, which are by law selected exclusively by competitive admissions, all the de Blasio's, they've all got their, they got a target on them, right? They want to start racially curating who gets in there. And the idea is, hey, you know, conservatives can appeal to Asian voters, you know, by opposing things like gifted and talented programs and things like that. And I'm like, you know, I've been listening to the GOP talk about appealing to minority voters for decades now. And yet here we are. The only minority groups that I know of that vote Republican are Cubans and Orthodox Jews. Now, Filipinos and Vietnamese, Southeast Asian groups, they're around 50-50 Democrat-Republican, I think. I can't, maybe there's a few other little niche groups here and there, but basically every minority group in the country votes overwhelmingly for Democrats. So after years of trying and all this minority outreach and, you know, explicitly elevating and celebrating, you know, minority Republican politicians like Tim Scott or Nikki Haley, basically they have accomplished nothing. And I think part of that is they just don't even know what minority voters want. I mean, what they basically do is project their own desires onto those minority voters and say, you know, that's how we'll appeal to the Asian voter by, projecting on them the things that we would do if we were in their place. So this gifted and talented program, obviously that's something that kind of, you know, these kind of white parents, white elites, they, wow, we care about that. So obviously that must be a high priority thing for Asians too. And, you know, if we appeal to them on that, we're going to win. But, you know, maybe they don't care about it, or maybe they care about it, but they care about other things more. You know, a lot of times with voting, there are kind of identity issues in play. An example of that people always talk about is, you know, these sort of white, blue-collar union Democrats. You know, it's like, I'm a union family. I work for GM. We're Democrats. Democrats are for the working man. And that sort of identity of, I'm a union guy. I'm a, so I'm a Democrat. That was very deep in a lot of people in that baby boomer generation. And so it was multi-generational loyalties in some ways. Now, there's some truth in that. That wasn't just, you know, what's the matter with Kansas? Kind of like, oh, they're stupid. Don't they know the Republicans care more for the, well, the Republicans did not care for the unions. The Republicans want to bust the unions. Okay. So it doesn't mean that the policies around unions and manufacturing job and trade aren't legitimately bound up into that, but there's also an identity element to that as well. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, for a lot of evangelicals, being a Republican, right, goes along with the identity of evangelical. So, this assumption that this group of people that you really don't know anything about are going to want to vote for you because of some policy that actually you want. It's not necessarily something that they want. It's not like, oh, I'm hearing them talk about all these things they want, and boy, I want to tell them I'll give them that. It's like, you know, this is something that we want anyway and that we would be arguing for even if they didn't exist. This idea they're going to vote for you on that basis just doesn't make any sense. Now, again, I'm not going to tell you that I understand what drives Asian voting decisions. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure the conservative leadership doesn't know either. And these sorts of, you know, cheap minority voter outreach efforts have just never worked, which we see. And, you know, it's weird. You know, you look at it, Donald Trump's minority vote share, right, for the Republican vote share for Donald Trump 2016 increased over Mitt Romney 2012, you know, among Blacks, Hispanics, basically everybody. So his Hispanic vote share went up in 2016 after he said, I'm going to build a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. That's pretty crazy. And, you know, again, coming out, you know, Obama sort of riding a wave and, you know, very popular. And so maybe there should have been some kind of just pendulum swing and he may have went that. But then you look at 2020, his Hispanic vote share went up again. And if you go talk to any, like, one of these GOP brain trust type people, say, you know, what do Republicans need to do to appeal to the Hispanic voter? I bet the Trump policy set or style would not be anywhere on that list. And yet, you know, it was. So it's like, I'll show you, like, they don't understand why Hispanics vote the way they vote. Their theories of voter behavior are totally wrong. So, you know, they can't really even effectively rhetorically oppose it because they can only make these appeals based on, you know, sort of the left's moral system. Oh, don't you know that you're harming minorities when you do this? You know, which that doesn't work any more than you know, some Democrat, you know, pro-abortion Democrat coming to a, you know, conservative Christian in Texas and saying, you know, if you really cared about women and babies, you would not support this Texas abortion law because don't you know this is going to cause people out of state, it's going to do this. I mean, you wouldn't buy that for a minute if they made that sort of article from you, right, if you're conservative. So what makes you think they're going to make that? They're not. And when it comes to appealing to minority voters, there's no evidence that the Republican Party actually understands anything about what would actually drive increased Republican vote share among minorities. So even then, their engagement in this stuff is, you know, flawed in any respects. But why are they engaging in it at all, I think, is the bigger question. Because when one of these far-left jurisdictions does something, right, again, unless you have a tie to that place, right, or you're one of my listeners, right, who's involved in progressive politics, I know I got some, or something like that, it's not your problem. It's their problem. You know, I mean, your concern ought to be much more about how do we keep this from happening in our community? Because what happens in San Francisco and New York, you know, you can write it down, it's going to be filtering down to wherever you live at some point in the future. And this is actually very hard. Again, I was raised, you know, in this very conservative way. And so, you know, I've internalized many of these same behaviors. So I actually tweeted an article from a former local journalist in Chicago who'd discovered that the Art Institute of Chicago, which is one of the world's great art museums, really great museum, that the new head of the women's board had fired all of the docents. So they've got these people who kind of give tours and things like that. They're all volunteers. None of them are paid. And they're actually really, really knowledgeable about the art. And there were, you know, 80 to 120 of them, depending on which categories you count. And they're basically like, we're getting rid of all you volunteers. We don't want your help anymore because too many of you are white. Okay. And so, you know, I tweet about that. But, you know, I realize, I was like, wait a minute. Probably 100% of those volunteer docents who are now all upset are progressives, and they probably support 100% right down the rails of all the stuff woke line on race. They probably do. Now, I did used to live in Chicago, so I do have a tie there. But, you know, again, it's just a little something. And I'm not saying you never had to tweet, right? But when you're relatively powerless, right, you know, as conservatives were in the 60s, and in fact, sort of as they were today, you got to think much more about how to advance the ball for your people and your idea, and less about, you know, and, oh, by the way, making sure your own leaders are doing something, which they usually aren't. And that's what I think a lot of this boils down to. You know, conservatives love to try to distract their own voters with fear-mongering about socialism. Oh, you know, the Democrats are going to bring us socialism or something like that. And, you know, so they want you outraged about what Bill de Blasio is doing so that you're not thinking too much about what Mitch McConnell is doing or about what the no-account, you know, governor of your own red state is doing or not doing or any of these people. They want you focusing on outrages in San Francisco instead of thinking about what's going on at home. And so I think that's maybe part of what's going on here. But I think, you know, hey, let's focus on our own business. Are we taking care of business? What's going on in our community? What are the things that affect, you know, our voters? Maybe we should work more about our own voters. You know, Democrats, actually the left, I give them great credit. They actually care about their own voters and their own constituencies. You know, it's going on a little longer than I thought here, but I'll, you know, bear with me for a second. You know, earlier this year, when Biden came in, they passed another massive coronavirus stimulus bill. I can't remember which one this was called, but a bunch of them. And there was a huge amount of aid directed to cities. And the formulas were set up to direct essentially all of that money to big blue, overwhelmingly voting Democratic cities. So, you know, here, the city of Indianapolis is getting $400 million from this bill. At $400 million, I think the budget's like $1.3 billion to the whole city. This is like an insane amount of money that they're giving, and he gave it all to them. And some of these more Republican or purple suburbs, they're getting like far, far, far left. In fact, I added up that the blue jurisdictions are getting 7.5 times more per capita than, you know, these suburban jurisdictions that are red or purple. They take care of their own people and they worry about their own agendas and their own problems. And yeah, of course, they're getting outraged about this, like the Texas abortion law. But, you know, unlike conservatives, they can actually do something about it. They can actually get judges to do something. What are any of these conservatives accomplishing on any of these problems? I don't see it. So, again, I point this out, you know, not so much over this particular issue, but just to recognize this pattern of behavior. Conservatives like to jump into the breach to try to save their opponents from the consequences of those opponents' own ideologies. They really have a pattern of doing that. And I noticed it in the Nash book, and I noticed it again today. I thought it was a good example of that. So something to keep in mind. And next week, we'll be back with another topic, maybe U.S. collapse topic, maybe not. We'll see. But in the meantime, take care.